to win a chance to have Fuzzy Boo at your event, as well as other prizes. Each picture you take is another chance to win. For more info and clues on where to find the van, go to kboo.fm/fuzzyboo.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Los Van Van Live in concert at the Tao Event Center, Saturday, August 20th in Portland. Los Van Van is a Grammy Award-winning Cuban salsa group that has been a pioneer in Cuban musical fusion for the last 48 years and is one of Cuba's most popular dance bands. Again, that's Grammy Award-winning Los Van Van Live in concert at the Tao Event Center, Saturday, August 20th at 8 p.m. in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland. It is 11 a.m., just 6.5 hours to go to the Eclipse Hate Rally. I believe it's at the Salmon Street Fountain. 5:30 p.m. this evening. Check it out. Coming up on the Radio Zine, we have the Sojourner Truth program looking at the past weekend's events in Virginia here on your community radio. Coast to coast solidarity, can you dig it? KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Donald Trump gives overt support for white supremacist organizations as they let the world know they were no longer hiding under sheets as in the days of the Ku Klux Klan. On Friday, August 11th, they descended on Charlottesville, Virginia, chanting blood and soil, a term from Nazi Germany. Jews will not replace us, white lives matter, and more. By Saturday afternoon, 32-year-old Heather Heyer was killed, run over by a vehicle driven by James Fields Jr., a participant in the white supremacist protests. 19 others were hurt in the incident, and 2 law enforcement officers were killed in a related helicopter crash. Donald Trump has come under fire for twice now, laying the blame for what happened in Charlottesville on both sides. He defended what he called peaceful, good people, participants in the white supremacist protests. He also complained about the bringing down of Confederate statues, including Robert E. Lee, who led the South against the United States government during the Civil War. What got us to this point? Did the Civil War ever really end? What is the historic context? Why is Trump's support in the polls remaining strong among his base? How are Black Lives Matter, now referred to by white supremacists as a terrorist organization, and other movements on the ground responding? Our guests are Dr. Gerald Horn, Ashley Henderson of the Highlander Institute, and Evan Birch, a divinity student with Black Lives Matter Nashville. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. President Donald Trump has come in for bipartisan criticism after he defiantly blamed both sides for the weekend violence between white supremacists and counter-demonstrators in Virginia. The president appeared to show sympathy for the fringe group's effort to preserve Confederate monuments.
You had a group on one side that was bad, and you had a group on the other side that was also very violent. And nobody wants to say that, but I'll say it right now. You had a group on the other side that came charging in without a permit, and they were very, very violent.
Democrats, Republicans, business leaders, and White House advisors pressured Trump earlier this week to more forcefully and specifically condemn the KKK members, neo-Nazis, and white supremacists who took to the streets of Charlottesville. The angry exchange with reporters at his skyscraper hotel in New York City stunned his top aides. New Chief of Staff John Kelly stood with his arms folded, staring at the floor as the rhetoric intensified. In recent days, business and labor leaders have withdrawn from a White House manufacturing panel. White supremacists and other groups organized the rally under a Unite the Right banner. They said they were protesting a plan to remove a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee, but also what they saw as an anti-white climate in America. Mourners will gather in Charlottesville, Virginia today to honor the woman who was killed when a car rammed into a crowd of people protesting a white nationalist rally. A memorial service for Heather Heyer is scheduled at a downtown Charlottesville theater. The 32-year-old was a Charlottesville resident and legal assistant. The man accused of driving the car that slammed into the crowd has been charged with second-degree murder in her death. Confederate monuments in Baltimore were quietly removed and hauled away on trucks in darkness today after a violent white nationalist rally in Virginia that was sparked by plans to take down a similar statue there. Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh told the Baltimore Sun that crews began removing the city's four Confederate monuments late Tuesday and finished around 5:30 a.m. today. Workers used a crane to lift the towering monument to Robert E. Lee and Thomas Stonewall Jackson onto a flatbed truck in the dark. The San Francisco Human Rights Commission hosted a community forum in response to the deadly white supremacist rally in Charlottesville over the weekend. The forum also addressed how best to deal with a planned far-right march in Chrissy Field later this month. Mira Nablusi reports.
Shimon Walton is the executive director of Young Community Developers. He says the racism the country is facing is not new.
There is a climate that is more receptive and more tolerant of the hate and the bigotry that goes on across this country.
Reverend Arnold Townsend is vice president of the NAACP of San Francisco. He said the current conversation on bigotry is not complete without reflecting on structural racism and income inequality in the Bay Area.
There's nothing more violent than people taking your homes and putting you and your children on the street.
Cheryl Davis, the director of the San Francisco Human Rights Commission, says that this meeting will be followed by more community forums and long-term plans. Reporting from San Francisco for the KPFA News, this is Mira Nablusi.
Sierra Leone's government is urging family members to identify their loved ones' remains following mudslides and floods in the capital that have killed more than 300 people. In a statement today, President Ernest Bai Koroma's office asked relatives to come to the city's overwhelmed mortuary. The statement says all unidentified corpses will be given a dignified burial in the coming days. The death toll is expected to rise after mudslides and floodwaters in and around Freetown this week killed hundreds of people. A Congressional Budget Office report says premiums for a popular type of individual health care plan would rise sharply, and more people would be left with no insurance options if President Trump makes good on his threat to stop Obamacare payments to insurers. The nonpartisan number crunchers also estimated that cutting off payments that now reduce copays and deductibles for people of modest incomes would add $194 billion to federal deficits over a decade. That's because a different Affordable Care Act subsidy would automatically increase as premiums jump, more than wiping out any savings. Senator Luther Strange and former Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore are headed to a Republican primary runoff to fill the U.S. Senate seat previously held by Attorney General Jeff Sessions. The two men, who represent different factions within the Alabama Republican Party, will face off next month in a runoff. I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. On August 12th, white supremacist, neo-Nazi, and KKK organizations came together for a Unite the Right protest in Charlottesville, Virginia, where a Confederate statue of Robert E. Lee was set to come down. According to Al Jazeera, the event was organized by a man named Jason Kessler, a member of the Proud Boys, an ultra-nationalist group. These white supremacists Organizations were met with hundreds of counter-protesters from Black Lives Matter and other movements. Violence broke out, and at 1:42 p.m., a speeding Dodge Challenger drove into counter-protesters, injuring dozens and killing 32-year-old Heather Heyer. The driver was James Alex Fields Jr., and he's been charged with second-degree murder. Following the attack, Republicans and Democrats both condemned the white supremacists that took to the streets of Charlottesville. But immediately after that, Trump failed to do so. He eventually issued a condemnation saying racism is evil. But he just changed his tune and went right back to his initial message, which was that both sides were to blame, both the white supremacists and the counter protesters. And then he gave a shocking defense, basically, of white supremacist organizations. Now, there's a lot that we have to cover during this hour, but for those of you who haven't heard what Trump had to say when he went off the rails at a press conference yesterday, or even if you've heard it, let's play part of what Trump had to say just yesterday.
What about the alt-left that came charging at the, as you say, the alt-right? Do they have any semblance of guilt? What about the fact they came charging, that they came charging with clubs in their hands, swinging clubs? Do they have any problem? I think they do. You had a group on one side that was bad, and you had a group on the other side that was also very violent. And nobody wants to say that, but I'll say it right now. You had a group on the other side that came charging in without a permit, and they were very, very violent.
Go ahead. Sir, do you think that what you call the alt-left is the same as neo-Nazis?
All of those people, I've condemned neo-Nazis. I've condemned many different groups, but not all of those people were neo-Nazis, believe me. Not all of those people were white supremacists. And you take a look at some of the groups and you see, and you know it if you were honest reporters, which in many cases you're not, but many of those people were there to protest the taking down of the statue of Robert E. Lee. So this week it's Robert E. Lee. I noticed that Stonewall Jackson's coming down. I wonder, is it George Washington next week? And is it Thomas Jefferson the week after? You know, you really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
Are you putting what you're calling the alt-left and white supremacists on the same moral plane?
I'm not putting anybody on a moral plane. What I'm saying is this. You had a group on one side and you had a group on the other, and they came at each other with clubs, and it was vicious, and it was horrible, and it was a horrible thing to watch. But there is another side. There was a group on this side, you can call them the left, you've just called them the left, that came violently attacking the other group. So you can say what you want, but that's the way it is.
Unbelievable performance. Yeah, well, very believable. You know, for those in the United States and around the world who were confused, who weren't sure that people in the United States had elected a racist as president of the United States, well, hopefully now they know. Trump, the first time he appeared in the New York Times was 40 years ago with racism against Black people in the family business, in the Trump family business. And according also to an article in The Intercept, he also was accused of ordering all Black employees off the floor of his Atlantic casinos during his visits, claiming laziness is a trait in Blacks, not anything they can control. Okay, he suggested the Native American tribe, they don't look like Indians to me. He mocked Chinese and Japanese trade negotiators. He mocked people with disabilities. He was made racist comments against Latino immigrants. And of course, we all know about the Muslim ban, and we could go on and on and on. What I'd like to do now, though, is to welcome our panelists, Dr. Gerald Horn, who holds the Morse Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's published more than 30 books, including Confronting Black Jacobins, the U.S., The Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic, and Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary. Dr. Horn, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'd also like to welcome Ashley Henderson. She describes herself as a Black Appalachian. She was born and raised in Southern Tennessee. She was an organizer for Project South. She's now with the Highlander Institute, and she's part of the policy table leadership team of the Movement for Black Lives. She also served as a former staff member of the Chicago Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee History Project. Ashley, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me, Margaret. It's great to be on with you again.
And Evan Bunch from Black Lives Matter Nashville. He is a divinity student there. He's formerly with Black Lives Matter Los Angeles, and he was arrested in a counter-protest after the Charlottesville protests. Evan, welcome.
Hi, Margaret. It's great to be here.
Okay, well, we're going to change the dialogue about what has been going on in Charlottesville and what it means across the U.S. a bit. And Dr. Horn, we're going to start off with you. And what I want to do is to put this in a historic context, because Dr. Horn, you have made the case many times on this show that people in the United States basically are still fighting the Civil War, that the Civil War isn't over. Also, we know of the Reconstruction period that had happened after the so-named emancipation, and then the backlash against Black people that happened after Reconstruction, and a number of people were saying that in the more recent history, there's been kind of like a new Reconstruction going on. And the question is are we now facing a backlash for a second time to a second Reconstruction? Dr. Horn, we're going to hear a short clip just giving our listeners a little background on the Reconstruction period.
The Civil War ends in 1865, and the Union Army celebrates with a triumphant parade down Washington's Pennsylvania Avenue. But while the fighting is over, conflict continues through the era known as Reconstruction.
One way of looking at Reconstruction is the struggle between North and South shifts from the battlefield to the political realm.
While you have 4 million formerly enslaved people, what is their status going to be moving forward?
The U.S. government sends the army to occupy the South and passes three historic amendments to the Constitution.
The 13th Amendment abolishes slavery in the United States. The 14th Amendment grants birthright citizenship to freed slaves. And the 15th Amendment provides freed slaves with the right to vote.
One of the striking things about Reconstruction is how within a very short time after the end of slavery, Southern states were electing Black officials. They were electing governors, they were electing members of Congress, they were electing local officials.
So that creates, in those early years of Reconstruction, 1865 until the early 1870s, a really revolutionary moment in American history, equally as revolutionary in some ways as the original revolution a century earlier.
But Reconstruction also brings widespread corruption, abetted by Northern carpetbaggers who come south to take advantage of the situation. White Southern resentment leads to increased violence, and it is clear that Reconstruction's days are numbered.
As soon as the North decided, okay, we've had enough of this conflict, we've had enough of trying to tell the South what to do, then Southern Blacks would be thrown back on the mercies, and they weren't very merciful at all, of the Southern white majority.
Reconstruction finally comes to an end in 1877 when the last Northern troops are removed from the South.
Reconstruction is generally thought to last about 10 years. In some ways, the struggle continued for another 100 years. It wouldn't be until the 1960s, not the 1860s, but the 1960s, that African Americans first really began to enjoy the rights that they were promised under the Constitution at the end of the Civil War.
Well, Dr. Horn, starting with you, I mean, that was a hopeful end, saying the 1960s, black people started to enjoy rights promise at the end of the Civil War. Looking at what happened this weekend, but also all of the killings of young black people across the nation in recent years, that certainly has not been the case. Dr. Horn, anything you want to add or tell us about the Reconstruction period and why you think the Civil War hasn't really ended in the United States and how that relates to what happened in Charlottesville?
Well, it's possible to say the Civil War has not really ended because the so-called Confederate States of America, which erupted in 1861 to overthrow the United States government in order to perpetuate slavery, enslavement of Africans forevermore, they were defeated militarily and not politically. And because they were not defeated politically, that is to say their ideas still held sway after they surrendered, to a certain degree we are still fighting the U.S. Civil War because those political ideas, white supremacy not least, are still on the table. They were not defeated politically because since 1776, when the United States was founded, this country has basically been operating on two tracks. One track has been the plundering of Native Americans and the enslavement of Africans. The other track has been the acceptance of European settlers of various stripes. The First Amendment to the United States Constitution, to its credit, broke on paper with European centuries of religious conflict, particularly Protestant versus Catholic. On paper, there was also a rejection of anti-Semitism. And what's so remarkable about the events in the United States of the past few days has been the fact that you had these terrorists, some might even call them vanilla ISIS, marching openly, chanting, "Jews will not replace us," in Charlottesville, Virginia, when many had thought that the question of the acceptance of Jewish Americans into the body politic and to all levels of U.S. society had been settled some decades ago. But with the President of the United States, who talks incessantly about the fact that his daughter is a convert to Judaism, his son-in-law is Jewish, one of his major supporters was the Jewish billionaire Sheldon Adelson of Nevada, he's a comrade of Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, apparently countenancing this kind of bigotry, perhaps this suggests that the United States is reaching a turning point. Now, this would not be the first time that anti-Semitism has marked a turning point. You may recall that about a century ago, a Jewish man, Leo Frank, was lynched in the state of Georgia. This outraged many. It caused many in the Jewish community of New York to begin to support the nascent NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and of course, Jewish lawyers played a pivotal role in the civil rights movement. That led to the retreat of the formal barriers of Jim Crow and white supremacy, but as noted, the actual barriers still remain alive and well. And with this man that now occupies the highest office in the land, we may be slated for a further retreat on the question of human rights and civil rights.
Yeah, and Dr. Horn, also looking at the history, I mean, Trump isn't clearly the first racist, you know, president in the White House. I mean, there are many, including some who were slaveholders, but notable, you have Andrew Johnson, for example, Woodrow Wilson, and even FDR. The story is when civil rights activists, campaigners approached FDR about the lynchings of black people in the United States. He said, "Well, I don't want to alienate the Southern white people." Dr. Horn, a quick comment from you.
Well, I think that part of the problem is that even those who consider themselves radical tend to take a romanticized view of the United States of America. They tend to play up what they consider to be the positive elements and downplay the negative elements. If we were to have an accurate and adequate analysis of politics in the United States, we'd point out that David Duke, who has been very much on the scene, not only in Charlottesville, but in congratulating Mr. Trump in repetitive tweets in recent days, in 1991, he received 55% of the Euro-American vote in a race for governor of Louisiana. For the last half century, in a remarkable, astonishing cross-class coalition, 9 out of 10 Euro-Americans in the South regularly vote for the GOP. As you noted in your setup piece, the Trump base, which is overwhelmingly comprised of those defined as white, has hardly been shaken by these latest revelations. I think that if we are to be honest, we would have to acknowledge that we have an uphill climb ahead.
Yeah, and Ashley Henderson, I mean, you are very, very much involved now in the movements happening now. Project South, where you formerly were now with the Movement for Black Lives. But listening to what Dr. Horn had to say, and also the clip we played around the Reconstruction period, how important do you think it is, and do you think it is relevant, looking and understanding that history in terms of plotting out now strategy and tactics responding to this horror that we are continuing to face? Ashley Henderson.
I think it's absolutely critically important, and I think some of the weight that the Movement for Black Lives, the sort of 21st century Black Liberation Movement, in the 21st century Southern Freedom Movement are holding right now is this reality that the past, the present, and our future is very much existing all at the same time right now, right? Like, we can't be talking about this fight that we're in Charlottesville or across the state of Kentucky where the traditional workers' party is trying to take over, or where Alabama secessionists are trying to take over the state, or any of the other places where white supremacy is rearing its ugly head, and it not be connected to this real long history of white supremacy in this country, right? We're just now in places like Durham, having folks take down statues, and in Greensboro getting apologies about the Greensboro massacre, something that happened decades ago, right? So I think that it's absolutely critical for us as we develop strategy to, one, know that we're not the first, last, or only to be in this incredibly important fight, but also to be able to learn from the lessons of the 20th century fight against white supremacy. I think that in a time where folks like 45 are telling us that there's an alt-right and an alt-left, that it's really critically important for us to not get caught up in the hype of that messaging, to control our own narratives by really naming who these white supremacists are, right? It's not just hate doing that, all this terrible stuff that we saw in Charlottesville. It's very literally human beings that are connected to jobs, that are connected to organizations, that literally have tactics and strategies that they're employing. And we need to be as savvy, and I think as Willie Baptiste would say, meet sophistication with sophistication in this moment.
Right. And also, Evan Bunch, on this, just the historic piece, I mean, you're active with Black Lives Matter. We'll talk in the second half of the hour a bit about your arrest and what happened and some of the tactics and strategies and discussions happening now within the movement. But your view about the historic piece.
Well, I have never known for Black folks to be free, historically and presently. And so the fight that we're dealing with now, this egregious, very extroverted racism that we're dealing with here in Charlottesville, is nothing new. But also, I don't think we should hang our hat here in Charlottesville, because we're seeing a lot of Republicans, you know, call out these Nazis, and it's making them kind of look good, you know what I'm trying
yep.
to say.
Uh-huh.
And then, like the doctor said, the historian said, there is a political strategy still present from history happening here today. And the real white supremacy is sitting in policy that is allowing for mass incarceration. That is allowing for black folks not to get access to really good jobs. That is allowing for Jeff Sessions to continue to push extreme sentencing and like these zero tolerance drug policies. It is allowing for the FOP to hire a person again, like FOP to fight for someone like Betty Shelby to become a police officer again. It is also like the Los Angeles Police Commission, who just yesterday found Carnell Snell Jr.'s murder in policy. Like this continual parody of state stakes and violence against black folks. And so history is not yesterday. History is still today. And that's my perspective.
Right. Okay. And we'll, of course, want our audience to know that Malina Abdullah, who's with Black Lives Matter Los Angeles and whom we partner with in with our new series of campaigners for Black Lives, was arrested yesterday down at the police commission protesting exactly what Evan was referring to. We're just going to take a short break. I want you to hear from the Freedom Singers, and then when we return, we're going to continue with our panel. The Freedom Singers, we will never turn back. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety, and you can check us out on our website at www.sotrueradio.org. And if you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. We would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Charlottesville, Virginia. We will now return to our panelists that are Dr. Gerald Horn, Ashley Henderson, and Evan Bunch. What I'd like to do is to also integrate a couple of short pieces just to hear how a black man who is considered part of the mainstream punditry class, I should say, responded to what happened in Charlottesville. This is from CNN.
I kept wondering, Van, I mean, he's surrounded by military people. H.R. Van Gaster, who's had an incredible career in the U.S. Army. The U.S. Army fought the Nazis in Europe. You know, Kelly, who was a Marine. I mean, most of the Marines were in the Pacific Theater, but there were Marines fighting against the Nazis in Europe as well. I mean, what do these people who are surrounding him think? Ivanka Trump, what, I mean,
yeah. I mean, for
Jared
me,
Kushner, what are they thinking?
I don't know, but I'll tell you what I'm thinking. I'm thinking about my godmother, Dottie Zollner, who's Jewish. I think about what she's gone through in her life, sticking up for civil rights, the stories that she's told me about her family and the things that her family suffered in Europe, and the fact that she can't count on the President of the United States to stand with her when a Nazi ran over an American citizen, killed an American citizen with ISIS tactics in our country. And my godmother can't come on the television and see the President of the United States show any sympathy for her, the father of a Jewish daughter. I mean, this is not funny. It's not cute. It's not a soundbite war. At a certain point, you have a lot of people now. It's not just the people you're emboldening. It's the people you're abandoning who now don't know if they have a government that gives a damn about them. Those are the people you have to worry about, too, because we're spiraling away from each other. We're spiraling away from each other. And I don't know what to say tonight. I usually have something clever or something smart. I'm just hurt. I'm sitting here hurt. And I think a lot of people are hurt tonight.
All righty, and that was Last Voice, very emotional, Van Jones. And before we hear more from Evan and Ashley and others, just to give you a sense of the chanting by these white supremacists, and a lot of people also don't get that when you see a bunch of white supremacists carrying torches, okay, and doing the kind of chanting that they were doing, this is to send a message of fear and intimidation to black people and to other people that they were chanting against, like, they're coming for you. Let's hear just a little bit of the sound from their protest.
Jews will not replace us! Jews will not replace us!
Evan, just unbelievable. I mean, you know that this stuff goes on. You know that it has gone on historically. And Evan, it also gives a little taste of what some of our ancestors faced and worse. But give us your reaction. I mean, you were part of a protest. I imagine that happened in Nashville, and you were arrested at the time. Your reaction to just what you just heard, and also why and what happened in Nashville in the protest you were involved in, Evan?
Well, quickly, I was on Twitter, and I'm not sure exactly where I was, but I saw, it was like late at night, and I was following Defend Seaville. It was an activist out in Charlottesville that was tweeting out, and there was no media going on. There was no mainstream media out there, and I was following Twitter, and they were showing this huge, massive group of folks out there, 500 some odd folks, with these tiki torches, yelling blood and soil, Jews will not replace us, and then some other racial remarks that were not shown on mainstream media. I just kept getting more angry and angry because, like, the world was not listening. The world was not paying attention. It was like, it was Friday night, and then the main thing was going to happen Saturday, and then Saturday happened, and some news folks finally made it out there, but it was just too late. Folks are already fighting, and we saw a young man just get beaten down by a group of Nazis there, a young black man. And then finally, we saw that young lady get mauled by that car. And it was right then I began to text some folks. I said, y'all, we need to do something. We need to say something, visual, whatever. And then spontaneously, we got together here in Nashville, a small group of us. And for our vigil, a nice 20-minute, 30-minute vigil to remember the lives of those who were lost and those who were hurt. And then folks were still angry. And right down the street from our vigil was this new sound stadium right in the heart of the black community of North Nashville. And it has gentrified North Nashville. And I told that white crowd, I said, look, use your white privilege for resistance and go to the stadium and tell these folks white silence is murder. This is what it means to be a Nazi. This is what it means for white supremacy to exist. This is what it means for the normalization of what it means to be white in this country. And we went over there with our anger, with our voices, and we started praying with our feet, and we let Nashville know that we will not allow for this neo-Nazi agenda to continue right here in Nashville. We didn't have to go to Charlottesville to see Nazis. I see Nazis every day when they kill Jacquees Scott Clemons here in Nashville in February, and the DA and Megan and Mayor Barry said that it was in policy, it was justified. I sit here every day and I watch them gentrify the black community and move them out to way out 30 miles out of Nashville. I watch it when they take all these young black kids in Nashville and fill up these juvenile jails. I watch it here in Nashville when the Fraternal Order of Police, which is headquartered here in Nashville, stand up for all these murderous police officers. This is white supremacy. This is Nazism that is operating not just in Charlottesville, but in Nashville. And so that's why we marched. That's particularly why I marched. I was charged with disorderly conduct when I got arrested, but they don't have any grounds. So I reported and just arrested us because they saw a black man in the midst of a crowd of like white folks, so he must be guilty. But that was not the last time I'm going to be arrested or march. Because I know, as any other activist knows, that your body must be on the line to make change.
Right. Thank you for that, Evan. And we'll come back to you as well. Ashley Henderson, just in terms of the response of the movement on the ground, I mean, you have David Duke praising and other white supremacists, Breitbart News praising Donald Trump, who basically came out very openly, more openly than perhaps he has in the past, as basically a racist and defending those organizations. And we know that you also work with the Movement for Black Lives. And there's now a call, people are already calling the Black Lives Matter movement or organizations terrorist organizations, and wanting the Justice Department to look into them already. Trump administration wanted the names of people who participated in protests against him on Inauguration Day, you know, the websites, et cetera, that they visited. But Ashley Henderson, just in terms of on the ground and the kind of activism you and others are involved in, what are your thoughts now, and what do you think people have to do, and what are the ways in which some people could get involved?
I think it's a really great question. I mean, as someone who was literally watching on my phone as my friend and comrade was arrested by, you know, white supremacist cops in the capital city of my home state, I feel now more than ever committed to this life of activism and organizing toward the liberation of our people. I think it's really important to remember that, like, for years now, the Movement for Black Lives, all of the many organizations that make up that beautiful family, have been asking people which side they're on, right? Like, Black Lives Matter, BYT 100, Freedom Inc., Project South, you know, the Highlander Center, all of these organizations have been asking folks continuously, like, do you believe Black Lives Matter or not? And I think that, like, it's time out for the which side are you on question. You are very, very clearly in this political moment where white supremacists are literally taking over every aspect of our lives, whether it's making the laws that impact us, whether it is, you know, being out in the streets and violently, you know, attacking us and trying to scare us into staying home when we could be out in the streets and building the new world that we've always deserved. I think that now is the time to not ask which side are you on. I think that's very, very clear. I think the question in this political moment is what will you do to win this fight, right? Like, they have made it very, very clear that they feel like they're at war with us. They have made it very, very clear that they have both the political clout and financial resources to make that so. And so now it is our time to really build the kind of infrastructure that will liberate our people in our lifetime and know that anything less than that is not acceptable. And so I think there's multiple ways that people can get involved. There's a wonderful collaboration of folks called Beyond the Moment. It was a campaign that the Majority, which is the name of the coalition, started this year, and it included over 50 organizations across the country, including like coalitions like the Movement for Black Lives, Mahinse, which is led by some of the most righteous immigrant rights folks in the country. It included folks in the environmental movement like 350.org, and it included folks in labor and workers' rights work like SEIU. It included the Women's March, many, many other folks, where we came together to say that we are bigger than the sum of our parts, and we're stronger together. We're not alone in this work, and we don't have to be. And so we came together and did some work in April and May. Folks may remember the May Day actions that we hosted all across the country. And now we've come together again this week to say, after Charlottesville, it is time for folks of goodwill to stand together across all of our many differences toward the liberation of all people, and that we can't be all free if black folks are fearful for their lives in this political moment. So we offered many ways for folks to get involved. One is, like, we definitely know that our comrades in Charlottesville will continue to need support after the news cameras are gone, right? So we've asked for folks that are within 100 miles of Charlottesville to let us know so that when those comrades ask us for support, we can mobilize you quickly. We've also asked for folks to donate to the Bell funds that exist in the many, many, many cities and counties where these white supremacists are turning up, so that for our activist comrades that are prepared to put their very bodies on the line, very similarly to Evan's situation in Nashville, that we are able to protect and get our folks out of jail as soon as possible. And then we've also said that if you know that white supremacists are going to turn up where you are, we want to know about it, and we want to know what sort of movement response you all are preparing and how we can support it. So you can go to beyondthemoment.org, or you can go on the Movement for Black Lives website, and you can get in contact with us that way. And I think we'd be remiss to not offer that, like, very literally, folks aren't going to be distracted by white supremacists. We're going to keep on walking down Freedom Road, and that includes doing the work of building the new world that we want, not just resisting and pushing back and fighting back against this white supremacist upswing. So folks are going to be fighting on every single front in a multi-tactic strategy to learn as much as we can so that we can come up with these great strategies that will liberate our people, including fighting in policy fights and electoral fights, which will include building alternative institutions. All of those things are going to be really important, the base building work that folks across the country are doing to build up movement. All of that work is going to be critical, and we can't afford to leave any tactic behind. This is a by any means necessary kind of moment. And so we are excited, as the Movement for Black Lives and in relationship with all of the other movement institutions that are a part of the majority, to help hold this national moment and to help our people really feel prepared to fight back and build the new world that we deserve.
Right. Thank you, Ashley. And we'll also post those websites on the Sojourner Truth social media. And there's a whole platform also from Movement for Black Lives that people would be able to see on their website. Now, Dr. Gerald Horn, I was talking with Danny Glover just the other day. He reiterated a point he's made several times, which is that there'll never be democracy in the United States without this country addressing black people, the racist founding of this nation, the racism in the United States. I wanted you to comment on that. And also, Evan, I think it was, when he spoke earlier, talked about white silence is murder. And Dr. Horn, when you look at the reaction, you know, coming from white liberals, let's not even go to the racists, right? White liberals who are so shocked that this kind of thing can happen. Members of the Jewish community that are so shocked, right, about what happened. And also some people in the black community, some of whom could kind of easily go into this kind of anti-Jewish, mixing up Zionism with being Jewish, and that whole history of Jewish people and their involvement in the civil rights fight, in the South. But Dr. Horn, I'm wondering just some final thoughts from you on all this.
Well, I think that one inference we should clearly draw from the events of the past few days is that the process the United States has operated upon in terms of operating on two tracks, as noted by myself a few moments ago, plundering of people of color and then trying to direct certain rights to those defined as white, is no longer sustainable. I think that the vanilla ISIS terrorists who marched in Charlottesville were sending an anti-Semitic signal that they are determined to disaggregate whiteness, and they are certainly determined to expel Jewish Americans from their position as being part of the hallowed halls of whiteness. And that augurs, it seems to me, a catastrophe for all of us. I think that it also suggests that we need really new thinking on the theory and practice of fascism. It's not premature to start talking about the F word. When this phenomenon arose in Europe in the 1920s and the 1930s, the theory was that fascism was a response to the rise of a vigorous left-wing, radical, particularly socialist movement. Now, certainly we don't have that in the United States of America. At the same time, this is a settler colonial project that we have been enduring in North America, something our friends, even on the left, have not been willing to engage. And that suggests that if fascism arises on these shores, it may not necessarily be in response to a vigorous left. It may be in response to a perception of a rising black movement, particularly Black Lives Matter. And even though the previous president operated as a centrist, it's no accident that the leader of the birtherist movement, Donald Trump, who sought to suggest that Barack Obama was not born in the United States in order to delegitimate him, used it as a springboard to get elected in the United States of America. I think also we need to recognize that in a country that has endured slavery and apartheid, that the seeds of fascism inhere in a country that has countenanced slavery and apartheid, which leads me to the point that we need a new theory of the case. That is to say, if Nelson Mandela and his comrades had seen apartheid as an incomplete democracy, that Pretoria had been able to grant rights and privileges to those of European descent and by a mere absence of mind had forgotten to include the Africans and transpose that particular idea to the United States of America, and you get an idea of how folks have viewed the United States of America. If Nelson Mandela had taken that wrong-headed approach, it's difficult to see how he and his comrades could have developed a strategy to overturn apartheid. And finally, it seems to me we need to look at recent history. That is to say, I would argue that a conditioned precedent for the rise of the right wing in the United States was the previous historical epic, the Cold War, which involved an all-out attack on unions in the first place, which wrongly were viewed as a stalking horse for Moscow, yeah, and therefore were destroyed. And I would argue that that had a devastating impact on the white working class in the first place, helping to lead them down the primrose path of supporting, at least many of them, Donald J. Trump. Therefore, digging ourselves out of this hole involves, in the first place, a rebuilding of unions.
Right. And looking at the clock, I mean, we're going to have to continue this discussion again on yet another show. But Evan, we just have really about a minute or so. And so many young people that I talk to, black, including my daughter, of African descent, people are afraid. They're hurt. People are afraid. Young people are afraid to go out on the street. Mothers are terrified because we don't know when we're going to lose our children. Evan, just your thoughts on this. What do you say to young people?
I say that that fear is nothing new, and it's something that as black folks we have to strategize around every day when we go to work, when we go to school, when we go out into the public arena. We have to strategize and deal with colds and how to talk with one another. And so I say, possess the spirit of your ancestors. Call on your grandparents. Call on those who have walked in those same shoes. And call on their energy to guide you and give you strength to make it through this and to also fight. Because as activists and organizers, we are not fighting out of a vacuum. We are praying on our knees. We are also calling on the Lord. We're calling on so many spiritual forces to give us strength during this time. And so you don't just need yourself. You need the supernatural presence of those who have gone before us to guide us through this thing. And call on them. Call on your grandmother. Call on your grandfather. Call on that past civil rights leader or those who you know who have put their faith to the test to give you the strength to keep going on. It's going to be tough, but I really believe that we are going to win. There's too many benchmarks and too many milestones for us to look at to know that with our sheer tenacity and our rugged faith that we can make it to the other side. So keep on praying and keep on believing, and we can make it.
Right, and Ashley, we literally just have 15 seconds or so. I'm going a little over. I wonder, just quickly, some words from that Asata chant that I know is so prevalent among Black Lives Matter.
Oh, yeah, and it remains to be true that it is our duty to fight for our freedom. It is our duty to fight for our freedom. It's our duty to win those fights. Mm. We've got to love and support each other. And if we do all of those things, if we fight to win, if we love and support each other, we have nothing to lose but our shame.
Okay, on that note, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank all of you for joining us, and we'll have you back so we can continue this discussion. Today's show, produced by Margaret Prescott, I'd like to thank Black Lives Matter Los Angeles, and also our intern, Sherelle Withers, our assistant producer, Stephanie Case, and Mr. T, Teddy Robinson, back in the house. Stay tuned for Rising Up. This is Margaret Prescott. Thank you for listening.
And you are listening to KBOO. I'm Robin Shanti. I'll be sitting in for Lori Sonnenfeld today. And got a lot of stuff lined up. A lot of things going on in the world. If you haven't heard yet, Steve Bannon is out at the White House. Unfortunately, if Twitler thinks that that is going to be... his, what do you call it, acquiescence that he was wrong in what he said, history will record the permanent stain that resulted from his actions.
Out of power, here they come, international loan sharks, backed by the guns of market-hungry military profiteers, whose word is a swamp and whose brow is smeared with the blood of the poor. Who rob life of its quality, who render rage a necessity, by turning countries into labor camps, modern slavers and dragons, champions of freedom. Sinister, cynical instrument who makes the gun into a sacrament, the only response to the deification of tyranny, a so-called developed nation's idolatry of ideology. North, south, east, west, kill the best and buy the rest. It's just spend a buck to make a buck. You don't really give a flying fuck about the people in misery. IMF, dirty MF, takes away everything it can get. Always making certain that there's one thing left. Keep them on the hook with insupportable debt. The paid off local bottom feeders, passing themselves off as leaders. Kiss the ladies, shake hands with the fellows, and it's open for business like a cheap bordello, and they call it democracy. 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 See the loaded eyes of the children too, trying to make the best of it the way kids do. One day you're gonna rise from your habitual feast and find yourself staring down the throat of the beast they call a revolution. IMF, dirty MF, takes away everything it can get. Always making certain that there's one thing left. Them on the hook with portable dead. And they call it democracy. And they call it democracy. And they call it democracy.
Up with a retirement plan, lots of low tax dough. Go down White House, way down in payoff land. Tell the CIA, leave the Saudis alone. There's oil and gas in Uzbekistan. Oil and gas must flow. So we deposed the Taliban. Where'd Osama go? Bend down Congress. Kneel down and lend a hand. Tell the people liberty must go. There's more to gain in war than peace. Let the weapons flow. Destabilize the Middle East. Enrich the CEO. Go down, brother, way down on Florida sand. Tell the justices not to let my people vote.
KBOO Portland.
The VP had a heart attack. Oily blood, you know. While he's still here, let's bomb Iraq. Give the rubes a show. Lie down, people.